From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the poetry of an 18th century Vietnamese concubine who challenged the sexual, social, and religious conventions of her time. We talk with John Balaban, who translated her work. Balaban has collected Vietnamese oral poetry since the war in Vietnam. He first went there as a conscientious objector. Also, we remember Charlie Lurie, the co-founder of the jazz reissue label Mosaic Records. He died Sunday. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Ken Burns' new documentary series Jazz, which premieres next week on PBS. And film critic Henry Sheehan reviews Traffic. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President-elect Bush met with executives from high-tech companies today in Austin, and he had high praise for a segment of the economy that's taken a beating on the stock market this year. NPR's Don Gagne reports from Austin.
Bush told reporters after his two-hour meeting with the executives that even though it's been a difficult year, that he's optimistic that the outlook for the high-tech industry is a positive one, adding that these firms represent, quote, the leading edge of thought in the world. Unlike the meeting a day earlier with a broad cross-section of U.S. corporate leaders, this meeting did not focus on Bush's call for a big across-the-board tax cut. These executives from AOL and Sun and IBM and Cisco, to mention a few, talked with Bush about education and what they see as the need to make sure there are enough skilled workers to move into jobs that are being created in their industry. One said the reality is that the jobs will go to where the qualified workers are, wherever that is in the world. Don Gagne, NPR News, Austin.
The president-elect named two of his closest campaign advisors to senior jobs in his administration today. He chose campaign manager Joe Albaugh to lead the Federal Emergency Management Agency and political strategist Karl Rove as senior White House advisor. Bush spokesman Ari Fleischer said today that FBI Director Louis Freeh is expected to serve out the remaining 2 years of his term. President Clinton named Freeh to head the Bureau for a 10-year term, but the two haven't always seen eye to eye. President-elect Bush told reporters today that he expects his nominees for cabinet posts to face tough questions. One of his first choices, Commerce Secretary nominee Donald Evans, got a warm welcome at his Senate confirmation hearing today. The Federal Reserve Board has moved again to cut one of two interest rates it controls, though the move by the Fed's Open Market Committee was less dramatic than yesterday's action. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
In keeping with this week's movement outside of regularly scheduled meetings, the Federal Reserve Board's Open Market Committee instituted yet another interest rate cut, this time cutting the rate it charges member banks to borrow by a quarter point. While cuts to the so-called discount rate are largely symbolic, it would seem to be yet one more indication of how seriously the Fed views the current economic situation and growing evidence of major slowing on the part of the U.S. economy. The Fed acted on the requests of all 12 regional Fed banks in instituting the quarter-point cut, something it had said it stood ready to do at the time it announced its initial rate reduction. With the latest move by the Fed, both the discount rate and the much more important federal funds rate have now been trimmed by 0.5%. In its latest statement, the Fed says the quarter of a point cut to the discount rate completes the action begun on Wednesday. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 33 points to close at 10,912 in very heavy trading of more than 2 billion shares. The Nasdaq lost 50 points. This is NPR News. A team of scientists from the drug company Glaxo Welcome has developed a compound that can prevent hair loss caused by chemotherapy, although for now the compound has only been tested in animals. NPR's Joe Palca has more.
Chemotherapy works by killing rapidly dividing cells, and cancer cells typically divide more rapidly than healthy cells. But there are some healthy cells that do divide rapidly, including the cells that give rise to hair on the scalp. Killing them makes hair fall out. So the Glaxo Welcome researchers looked at molecules that might block the effect of chemotherapy on certain cells. They found one that blocked an enzyme critical for cell development, made it into a cream, and then rubbed it on rats before subjecting the rats to various chemotherapy regimens. The pre-treatment prevented hair loss in some of the rats. The researchers say the work is preliminary, and it will be some time before it can be considered for testing in human cancer patients. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
The Seattle Times and its striking unions have reportedly reached a tentative contract settlement. The strike has stretched into its 45th day, in part because of a dispute over the status of workers hired to replace the strikers. The company says it will have to lay off workers because of the cost of the strike, and it wanted to give replacement workers preference over returning strikers. The union says its leaders have reached a compromise that will have half the union members back to work within 90 days and all back within 180 days. The agreement was worked out with the help of a federal mediator in Washington. Last week, newsroom workers at the Seattle Post-Intelligencer also ratified a contract. In stocks today, the S&P 500 lost 14 points or 1% to close at 1333. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, saluting cultural programming on NPR, the recipient of the Year 2000 National Medal for the Arts.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, John Balaban, has been collecting and translating the work of Vietnamese poets ever since the war in Vietnam. During the war, he was a conscientious objector who worked in Vietnam teaching English and helping to rescue war-injured children. Balaban has just translated a book of poems by an 18th-century Vietnamese woman named Ho Xuan Hung. Her work is remarkable for the ways in which it challenged the sexual, social, and religious conventions of her time. The poems were written in a form of Vietnamese that is virtually extinct, called Nam, which Balaban is trying to preserve. The collection of poems is called Spring Essence. During President Clinton's trip to Vietnam, he mentioned the book as an example of how Vietnamese culture is reaching other parts of the world. Many of Ho Xuan Hung's poems have two meanings, one of which is sexual. Balaban says that was very unusual for the time.
It's one of the things that struck people immediately about Ho Xuan Hung in her own lifetime, and it's probably why her poems exist in Vietnam in, say, a half a dozen different printings on the street today. No one ever dared talk about sex in poetry. The nude in painting was a forbidden topic, and here was a woman, which was remarkable in the tradition of Vietnamese poetry, which is mostly male. Here was a woman who was writing these perfectly made lusher, regulated verse poems, which, if you looked at them or listened a little more carefully, had a second meaning, and the meaning was unmistakably sexual.
That word you use, lusher?
Lusher.
Lusher, that's a form of poetry.
It's a form that was made classical in the Chinese Tang Dynasty in the 7th, 8th, 9th centuries. And the Vietnamese used it as a classical form, say, the way we use the Italian sonnet in English. It became the lyric vehicle for carrying poetry.
Let me ask you to read one of the poems that has two meanings, one which is sexual. And this is called Three Mountain Pass.
People have wondered for a long time where this Three Mountain Pass was. Scholars have located it, and, you know, it's a curious mountain pass. And, of course, it's a bit naive to wonder where these mountains are. They are actually in nature, but if you look at them closely, you'll realize that it's also another landscape hidden within the mountain landscape. And here it is. A cliff face, another, and still a third. Who was so skilled to carve this craggy scene, the cavern's red door, the ridge's narrow cleft, the black knoll bearded with little mosses? A twisting pine bough plunges in the wind, showering a willow's leaves with glistening drops. Gentlemen, lords, who could refuse, though weary and shaky in his knees, to mount once more? Now, for the English reader, I think when you get to mount once more, you begin to suspect something was happening. For the Vietnamese reader, the cavern was looking a little suspicious earlier, but as soon as they saw the pine bough and willow, they knew it was man and woman. And for anyone who reads Ho Xuan Hung habitually, you realize that as soon as she says, gentlemen, lords, she's about to say something rude about something or another. Here's how it sounds in Vietnamese. Deo bai yoi. Một đeo, lại một đeo. Can I kêu tắc cản treo leo? Cửa sân đỏ luet, tâm hồn nhóc, hồng đã sân rì luân vương reo, lát lẻo khẳng thông khẳng gió tháp, đậm đĩa là liễu giọt xương yêu, hiền nhân quân tử ai mà chẳng, mời gới trọng trấn vẫn muôn trèo. And then there's another thing that happens in her poetry that just can't happen in English poetry because we don't have word tone. But for instance, the word Deo, mountain pass. The first line begins Mot Deo, Mot Deo. But Deo has an echo. If you change the tone on Deo, it also means to have sex. So she's not saying one mountain, still another. She's saying something else as well.
Now, how is it that the double entendres function so differently in Vietnamese? You talked about the Vietnamese language as being a tonal language, and one word can have different meanings depending on what tone is used to speak it?
Right. For instance, if you say la with a high-rising tone, it just means leaf. If you say la with a low, constricted tone, it means strange. If you say la, it means to be tired. If you say la it with a falling tone, it means it's the verb to be. If you say la with no tone, it's the verb to shout. So here's what to an English ear would be one syllable, but to a Vietnamese ear, six different words with six different meanings. And in poetry, she can take terms that have an innocence to them. Her favorite, for instance, is lon leo, which means to get twisted. So for instance, if you're talking about a kite string or the rope on a mast of a ship, it's a fair and usable term, long leo. But if you reverse the tones, leo, long, then it means something else. And, of course, that meaning is obscene.
Oh, okay. how do you know in print which of the meanings it is? Because you're not hearing the tone.
Well, in print, for the last several hundred years, the Vietnamese have devised a writing system that looks like Roman script, except for these little marks, these diacritical marks that are above and below the syllables, and they tell you the pitch. So, in fact, if you take away those diacritical marks, Vietnamese can't read. It all turns out to be monotone and doesn't make any sense.
Let me ask you to read another poem with two meanings, one of which is sexual, and this one is called Weaving at Night.
Weaving at Night.
Do you want to introduce this poem for us, set it up for us?
Sure, you have to picture a loom. You have to picture a woman seated before the loom, her feet on the treadle below, and working a shuttlecock through the threads of what will become a garment or a rug or something. And I guess already you can see the possibilities of double meanings here. Weaving at night. Lamp wick turned up, the room glows white. The loom moves easily all night long as feet work and push below. Nimbly, the shuttle flies in and out, wide or narrow, big or small, sliding and snug. Long or short, it glides out smoothly. Girls who do it right let it soak, then wait a while for the blush to show.
When people would recite these poems for you as you were collecting them, did they ever giggle? Do people, you know, do the Vietnamese giggle when they read something that has a sexual double meaning?
Well, if you say her name, people start to smile in Vietnam. And all her poems aren't all that well known. Some, you know, have been recited for the 200 years since her death. And others are more obscure, more difficult. And partly that's how I was led into translating her, deluded a bit by how difficult it would be. But I'd started translating Vietnamese oral poetry, the poetry called Cai Gao, which is actually sung out loud. And I did that during the war. I went around with a tape recorder, walked up to people in fields and behind their homes in the evening, and asked them to sing me their favorite poem. And they did. The word stock of that poetry is basically Vietnamese with hardly any Chinese borrowings at all. And there's a straightforwardness to it, a lyric beauty certainly, and a melody that accompanies everyone, but a straightforwardness. And I knew that Ho Xuân Hung used the language of the common people, and that's one of the reasons why she so valued even today, as someone who did not turn towards Chinese poetry, but say like Chaucer in English or Dante in Italian, chose to write in the national language, writing in a script that Vietnamese had developed that looks like Chinese, but in fact represents Vietnamese speech. So at first it seemed like I could make a jump from the fairly straightforward oral folk poetry into the high literary tradition that she represents. But really it was naivete on my part. So a lot of people know a number of her poems, but probably the whole corpus is a little more complex, even for Vietnamese, than certainly I had first guessed when I more or less stumbled into translating her.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Balaban, and for years he's been translating Vietnamese poetry into English. His new collection is called Spring Essence, and it's the poetry of Ho Xuan Hung, who was an 18th century poet. She was also a concubine, and among other things, she wrote about the condition of women. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. You're just joining us. My guest is John Balaban, and he spent years translating Vietnamese poetry. His new book is a collection of the poems of Ho Xuan Hung, and she was a Vietnamese poet who was born in the late 18th century. Ho Xuan Hung was a concubine. What does that mean?
It doesn't mean, I think, what we think it means when we say the word concubine. The Vietnamese term for her is Vo Le, or second wife. And there were all sorts of levels of being Vo Le, from something that might be what we mean when we say concubine to someone really who had quite high status in society. And she was an aristocrat, besides being the second wife, as her mother was a second wife.
Second wife doesn't mean the first wife is divorced or deceased.
It means the man has two wives. Two, three, or four, or five. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were rules in her time for the king, for instance, could have 126 wives. A college student at the time could have seven wives. It was a time when Vietnamese society was falling apart. It was around 1800 that she flourished. The French had begun their invasion. The Lay dynasty was falling apart. The Trinh clan lords in the north had more or less captured the throne. The Nguyen lords in the south were fighting that capture. And then out of this rose two brothers called the Taishan, and they began a populist rebellion that conquered Hanoi, Saigon, and drove out the Chinese at the same time. And this populist dynasty lasted about 24 years. She was related to it. She actually was a cousin to one of the Taishan emperors. So she, while she was a concubine, she also was a very well-placed aristocrat. And there's speculation that part of the interest in restoring the Vietnamese-ness of Vietnam and throwing off the Chinese feudalism that had so calcified the country, that she was actually a factor in that, an important political factor.
I'm going to ask you to read a poem that is about being a concubine. It's called On Sharing a Husband.
She was a Vo Le, or a concubine, or a second wife, more accurately, albeit a high-ranking one. But she resented the condition. And by her time, the condition of women in Vietnam, condition which historically was high, in that women were involved in politics, women often led armies, women controlled a good deal of the wealth, the inherited wealth of Vietnam, as they still do today. But by the latter 1700s, when Vietnamese society was falling apart, it was very hard for a woman of her class to get a marriage, a proper marriage, a first marriage. And so she shared her husband's, as in this poem. Screw the fate that makes you share a man. One cuddles under cotton blankets, the other's cold. Every now and then, well, maybe or maybe not. once or twice a month, oh, it's like nothing. You try to stick to it like a fly on rice, but the rice is rotten. You slave like the maid, but without pay. If I had known how it would go, I think I would have lived alone.
Do you think of her as a social critic?
She is an absolute social critic. Yeah. She, I mean, the word feminist comes to mind, but one hardly dares apply it 200 years after her death. I mean, but her concerns for women, her indignation at male authority, when she refers to mandarins or the literary elite, she's almost always scornful. Yet she probably survived because of them. She was so clever, so utterly brilliantly clever in composing poems, perfectly made, regulated verse off the top of her head, that she had the admiration of the power elite of her society. And there are poems that we have of hers where she's trading barbs with high-ranking mandarins. The things that she wrote about and the way that she wrote about them, some of them really were punishable. It's amazing that she got away with it. But I think it was the sheer audacity and the cleverness of her poetry that helped her survive.
What would the punishment have been?
Well, if you ridicule the king, the punishment is the sword. And there are other things. She wrote poems, for instance, in praise of unwed mothers. Now, in the countryside, to have a child out of wedlock is no big deal. And it's considered okay. But for a woman of her aristocratic class to have a child out of wedlock, the punishment would have been to oblige the pregnant woman to lie down while a war elephant would have been brought up, its foot placed on her stomach and then brought down till she and the unborn child were killed. So she lived in a world of such fixed rigidity that she resented it, and she saw outside of her, in the village, on the street, in the market, and in the simple beauty of the world of poetry that she had memorized, another way of living, and she refused to give up one for the other. And I think that probably also is why Vietnamese love her poetry today, the sheer maverickness of it, as well as the virtuosity of it, is what kept her alive then and probably what keeps her going even now.
Was she ever rewarded for writing poems?
No, she was famous immediately, and I guess that was her reward. There's no monetary reward. There wasn't a book of hers published in the, even in the quasi-modern sense, until 1909, which is maybe 75 or so years after she died. And that was a woodblock. The amazing, or one of the amazing things about Spring Essence, that I really can't take credit for, is that it's printed in three scripts. My English translation and introduction, modern Vietnamese, which looks like Roman scripts but with those diacritical marks, and Nam, the Chinese-looking script that she actually wrote in. And Nam has never been printed until this book. It was done by hand or by woodblock cuts, as her first book was done 75 years or so after her death. But there is about 1,000 years of this literature in Nam. You know, Vietnamese started writing in it around 1000 AD. There's some stele in Hanoi, stone carvings in Nam. They stopped around 1900. There are something like 79 million Vietnamese in the world and about 30 who can read Nam. So as I was working on this book, I realized that within my generation, 1,000 years of writing, not just poetry, but medical treatises, philosophical treatises, government documents, historical records, all would be lost. It seemed to me an incredible thing. And so I contacted a friend of mine, Ngo Tan Yan, a linguist at the Courant Institute of Mathematical Sciences, who knows Nam and who is also a sophisticated computer expert. And he created the Nam text for this book. And then after it was done, we realized that we had saved about 1,000 characters from oblivion and that there were 23,000 more to go. And we began a foundation, the Vietnamese Nam Preservation Foundation, to preserve, rescue, and extend Nam research so that more people can learn it and read it, and that that vast heritage of Vietnamese literary culture won't simply disappear.
Now, I think the reason why Nam had disappeared was that the French basically replaced it with a system of writing Vietnamese language with Roman letters.
That's absolutely true. There were decrees in the 1920s where the French forbade the use of Nam. It's also true that Nam is far more difficult to use than modern Quốc ngữ, or the Roman script, which was developed by a Jesuit priest around 1650 or so. But finally, even Vietnamese nationalists, communists included, decided that it was far easier to work with this Roman script, far more likely to make more people literate, so that today most Vietnamese can read and write, than Nam ever could. And, of course, that's true as well.
Can you read Nam?
No, I can read a few characters of it. I'm not one of the 30 people in the world.
So though
I'm president of the foundation, I still can't read it.
You're president of the foundation to preserve the language that you can't read, but that's understandable. I comprehend why you would want to do that, even though you can't read it. So I guess you had to work with a linguist.
We're working with a linguist here in the United States. My two colleagues in this foundation are James Doe Ba Phuoc out in California and Nhân up in New York. But there's the Linguistic Society in Vietnam, scholars at the Han Nam Institute in Hanoi that we're working with as well. What we hope to do is raise some money to, first of all, produce the first dictionary, actually a printed dictionary that will be accessible on the Internet so that it can be accessible to lots and lots of people worldwide.
Does the current government in Vietnam have a position on Hu Xuan Hung's poetry?
They used to have a fairly hard-line position having to do with social decadence, as you can imagine. But also others, even in the more Stalinist period of Vietnamese politics in the North, never failed to point out that she was a populist, that she was interested in Vietnamese language as a vehicle for poetry, that her sentiments about nationhood are sometimes very clear and patriotic in the poems. So they were protective of her for that reason as well. She's taught, and it seems incredible given the content of some of the poems, she's taught in high school. Almost every Vietnamese that I've spoken to remembers reading some Hu Xuan Hung poems in high school as well.
John Balaban edited and translated the new book Spring Essence, The Poetry of Hu Xuan Hung. Balaban is poet in residence and professor of English at North Carolina State University in Raleigh. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, recording Vietnamese folk poetry. We continue our interview with John Balaban. Also, we remember Charlie Lurie, the co-founder of the jazz reissue label Mosaic. He died Sunday. Kevin Whitehead reviews Ken Burns' new PBS series on the history of jazz. And Henry Sheehan reviews the film Traffic. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Balaban. He's collected and edited the poems of Ho Xuan Hung, an 18th century Vietnamese concubine who challenged the sexual, social, and religious conventions of her time. The book is called Spring Essence. Balaban has been collecting Vietnamese poetry since the war in Vietnam. John, you started collecting Vietnamese poetry as a result of living in Vietnam when you were a conscientious objector. Now, most conscientious objectors during the war in Vietnam did some kind of public service in the United States. How did you get to serve your public service in Vietnam?
I was a more militant conscientious objector. I could have carried bedpans in a VA hospital or something like that, but it seemed to me, one, I had an obligation to go to Vietnam, so I got a hearing at my draft board near Philadelphia and in Bristol, and I remember the day there was this group of rather old men who seemed as frightened of me and what trouble I might cause them that day as I was of them. And really, they only had one question. I swore in the Bible, stated my name, and they asked me, "Are you willing to go to Vietnam?" And I said, "I'm not willing. I'm going whether you approve my status as a CO or not." And I had a job already lined up as a teacher of linguistics at a Vietnamese university. That lasted, a few months because the whole place got bombed during the Tet Offensive. I was wounded. I came home. Then I went back again. I went to work for a group that treated war-injured children. And I did that for the rest of my alternative service. But by the time that was over, I had really begun to learn Vietnamese. And I came back again and got interested in this folk poetry called Cai Gao. This is an oral folk poetry. And I applied for a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and spent a year walking around the countryside. This is 1971-72. With a tape recorder. And literally, I would walk up to people. I was, 23, 25 years old. And if you try to imagine the reverse, if you try to imagine a young Vietnamese in his 20s walking up to American farmhouses and asking the people inside to sing him their favorite poems, you realize this huge cultural divide that I had stepped into the other side of, I guess. You want to hear one of those? They're sung, and it's about love, as a lot of Ho Xuan Hung poems are. This is a love lament, and it says in English, "Stepping into the field, sadness fills my deep heart. Bundling rice sheaves, tears dart in two streaks. Who made me miss the ferries leaving? Who made this shallow creek that parts both sides?" In Vietnamese, it's like this. Ha buk xương rừng sao mạn sao thác giả, tai ấm bó mà nước mát hai hàng, ai làm lo chuyên đỏ ngang, cho xăm cả nước ở, cho xăm cả nước đôi đàn biển ly.
So what did you learn about in asking where they heard the song, about how these poems were passed on from place to place and from generation to generation?
Most of the poems were heard just in those same environments, people hanging out with each other after the work was done. Sometimes older sisters, often mothers singing them to babies. Only one person in that whole year actually said, "I made that poem." The only person I found who said, I invented this poem myself, and then he sang it. Some of them had elements in them, poems that began, "In the year of the dragon, God sent down a flood," would be a first line. And you could figure out when there was a big flood in the year of dragon, and you could date the poem, 1904, for instance. And some of them had things in them that would give a sense of how old the poems were. But basically, these belong to everybody. They're sung and changed a bit probably every time they're sung and just polished a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more over the years. So, and they're still being sung.
Are they kind of anonymous in the way most American folk ballads are?
Yeah, no, in a very similar way.
But Ho Xuan Hung's poems apparently are not anonymous.
No, there are really these two great streams of poetry, the oral folk tradition and then the high literary tradition that she wrote in. As soon as you're writing a poem down, you're in that other tradition. She also, as great poets everywhere always are, someone working their craft in both traditions. So she knew that folk poetry as well. And often in her poems, you would find a phrase that would come right out of the marketplace. And if you go back to that love lament that I sang for you, here's a woman left behind, and she talks as if fate itself had created a stream that had come between her and her boyfriend, who's gone away for some mysterious reason. Well, Vietnamese have an incredibly romantic notion, and it centers around a single word, Zuyen, or Yien, which means fated love. And it means affection between a man and a woman so strong that even if they do not come together in this life, surely it will happen before two more incarnations. And this idea of Zuyen and hungering for the deepest kind of true love was really a factor in her poetry as well. So it wasn't a big jump in terms sometimes of theme from the folk poetry to Ho Xuân Hung.
I'd like you to leave us with another poem by Ho Xuân Hung. And let me ask you to read Spring Watching Pavilion. It's a beautiful poem.
It's a beautiful poem. And like many of her poems, it has a trick hidden within it, in that the place in the title, Dai Khan Xuân, refers to the place where she grew up near Hanoi. And, of course, Xuân is her own name, Spring. Her name, Xuân Hung, means spring essence. Hence the title of the book. And often when she's talking about the spring or the moon, she's referring to herself. But here she's referring to the world of samsara, the mutable world, the changeable world where we all perish. And she's talking about what preserves us in the vicissitudes of the world. Spring Watching Pavilion. A gentle spring evening arrives airily, unclouded by worldly dust. Three times the bell tolls echoes like a wave, and we see heaven upside down in sad puddles. Love's vast sea cannot be emptied, and springs of grace flow easily everywhere. Where is Nirvana? Nirvana is here, nine times out of ten.
John Balaban, thank you so much for sharing some of Ho Xuân Hung's poetry and some of your own experiences collecting poetry in Vietnam. Thank you.
Thank you.
John Balaban edited and translated the new book Spring Essence, The Poetry of Ho Xuân Hung. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews Ken Burns' new PBS series, Jazz. This is Fresh Air. Ken Burns' new series, Jazz, begins broadcasting January 8th on public television. Our jazz critic, Kevin Whitehead, says this 10-part, nearly 19-hour series is also a marketing juggernaut. You can buy the $200 DVD version, the $125 box set of videotapes, the $65 coffee table book, and 28 CDs worth of tie-in music. The TV series will be distributed to thousands of middle schools around the country and is likely to influence how people look at jazz for a long time to come. Kevin says, for all that, the series should be a lot better.
Ken Burns' jazz series contains a lot of what you'd expect. Little-known anecdotes and heartwarming stories, lots of zooms in and out on black and white photos, some eye-popping performance clips, and lots of stock footage of New York in the good old days. But overall, it's a mess. It doesn't swing. Sometimes it barely moves. Burns needs 2 of 10 episodes just to get from 1935 to 39. Time even flows backwards occasionally. Burns has a maddening way of plunging back into the middle of some period just when you think he's finally done with it, inspiring a deadly feeling of déjà vu. That carelessness with chronology carries over into the narrative, where images and music from various decades are tossed together, something he glosses over by not dating the clips we see. Burns and scriptwriter Jeffrey C. Ward are good at telling four-minute anecdotes, which makes a series perfect for switching over to during commercials on another channel. But with the chronology all screwed up, one rarely gets a sense of how one style evolves into another or how the role of individual instruments has changed over time. Where Burns's Civil War series minded privates as well as generals, his jazz is the great man theory writ large. I never thought I'd complain about too much Duke Ellington or Louis Armstrong on American TV, but there's so much of them here, they squeeze other greats right out of history. Deep down, Ken Burns seems less interested in the sound of jazz than the flickering images and talking heads on screen. We get the old adage that a jazz solo should tell a story, but it's amazing how seldom we get to hear a whole piece or even solo without a voiceover. Burns says he wants to bring new fans to jazz, but the way to do that is to let folks listen to it. He doesn't trust the music to tell its own tale. The series hits rock bottom with the last episode, where Burns makes up for lost time by streaking through the last 40 years of a 100-year-old art form in under 2 hours. He lets a couple of people diss pianist Cecil Taylor for his difficult music, instead of inviting Taylor to sit at the piano and explain what's going on. But then, not once in 19 hours does anyone sit at a piano to illustrate anything. Plus, Burns interviews surprisingly few musicians, although series advisor Wynton Marsalis pops up every few minutes to vividly describe events that transpired before he was born. Burns also finds time for multiple visits with two swing-era dancers, a baseball player, actor Ossie Davis, and a publicist who tells us that God sent Louis Armstrong to Earth to make people happy. Such modernists as Sun Ra, Eric Dolphy, Carla Bley, Anthony Braxton, and Julius Hemphill aren't even mentioned. But hey, neither are Oscar Peterson, Buddy Rich, or Rahsaan Roland Kirk. The real story of jazz in the 80s and 90s isn't even hinted at. How equally passionate liberals and conservatives battled over whether the music should continue to evolve or revel in its glorious past. No matter which side you backed, it's a hell of a good story. The classic American saga. It's the Civil War. But Burns appears constrained from telling it, since the main attack dog on the conservative side was the same Wynton Marsalis who tells us throughout the series that jazz musicians work out their differences on the bandstand with mutual respect. It looks as if Burns shaves the truth to avoid undercutting his star witness. That makes for good lawyering, but bad history. In the course of the series, there is rare footage worth keeping an eye out for, like Clifford Brown performing on the Soupy Sales Show, and some intelligent observations by writers Gary Giddens and Gerald Early, and saxophonist Jackie McLean, among others. But you have to wade through some fatuous commentary to get to them. In the end, Ken Burns' 2001 spectacular resembles Stanley Kubrick's 2001. It's underpopulated, moves really slowly for a really long time, and at the end turns into this fast, crazy trip through a universe that barely resembles ours. The difference is, with Kubrick, it works.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed the new jazz documentary series by Ken Burns, premiering January 8th. The recording careers of many great jazz musicians were brought into focus by the mail-order label Mosaic Records, which produces limited edition box sets. It has consolidated the work of celebrated musicians such as Thelonious Monk and Chet Baker, and under-acknowledged artists such as pianist Herbie Nichols and tenor saxophonist Tina Brooks, who we're listening to now. Brooks was a favorite of Mosaic co-founder Charlie Lurie. Lurie died this week at the age of 60 of cardiac arrest, after suffering with scleroderma, a rare viral disease. He founded the label in 1982 with Michael Koscuna. They met at Blue Note Records in 1975 when Lurie, then the director of marketing for the Blue Note label, hired Koscuna to do research in the vaults. They first established their Mosaic label by reissuing Blue Note sessions which had been languishing in the vaults. The Blue Note label is revered by many jazz listeners for launching what became known as hard bop, with now classic 1950s recordings by Art Blakey, Horace Silver, and Lee Morgan. I spoke with Lurie and Cascuna in 1996 after the publication of their book that told the history of Blue Note and collected the photos of Blue Note co-founder Francis Wolff, photos that are used on many Mosaic reissues. Lurie told me the Blue Note label helped shape his taste in music.
A lot of my tastes were already formed before I heard my first Blue Note album. I was listening to Benny Goodman and a lot of swing music. And I was a clarinet player myself, so those are the things that helped to shape me and direct my life. But as soon as I heard my first Blue Note album, and I believe it was a Horace Silver, my life changed. I had never heard music of that power and expressiveness before, and that simplicity. And from that point on, I became a convert, if you will, to Blue Note Records. And the fact that it was on Blue Note for many people was the same for me. If it came out on Blue Note, I was interested in it. And just to hold those albums, just to look at them, the weight of the vinyl itself and the graphics, the Frank Wolff photos and the liner notes, it was there was a whole gestalt to the label that was tremendously appealing, and it was like an old friend after a while.
Talk to you both a little bit about what it's like for you to reissue jazz. Let's start with why you formed Mosaic, why you decided to start your own mail-order business reissuing recordings from the past.
We were out of work, Terry.
That's a pretty direct answer.
No, aside from that, though, there was this is in the pre-CD era. And we're talking 1982,
mm-hmm.
And there was virtually nothing going on in the record industry with regard to jazz reissues, aside from what was going on at Fantasy with the twofers that they were putting out of Prestige and Milestone and Riverside Sessions. There was very, very, very little going on in the business with regard to jazz reissues. And there was a dearth of material in the marketplace. And a lot of great recordings were screaming to be available. There were new people coming along who had great need, great interest, great desire to be able to own this music and to learn from it and to enjoy it. And it just wasn't available.
When you decided to start Mosaic, you had already put in a proposal to Capitol Records to reissue their music from their vaults, which included the Blue Note masters. They declined, and then you decided to start Mosaic yourselves and to start your own program of reissues. When you decided to do that, knowing that you'd have access to the Blue Note vaults through Capitol, why did you decide to go in the direction of box sets? This was in the dawn of the box set era.
Yes, actually, I think in many respects, Mosaic led the way and showed the rest of the industry that box sets were viable. And our feeling was that we wanted to put out complete bodies of work, that we did not feel that we wanted to release individual compact discs and make decisions about or to do overviews of a career on one or two compact discs and make those kinds of decisions for people, that we felt that our our goal would be better served if we were to identify seminal periods in an artist's recording career and explore that in its totality. And that meant sizable releases.
Charlie Lurie co-founded the Mosaic record label. He died Sunday at the age of 60. Here's music from one of his favorite recordings, Hank Mobley's Soul Station. Coming up, Henry Sheehan reviews the new film, Traffic. This is Fresh Air. Steven Soderbergh's new film, Traffic, about drug trafficking, stars Michael Douglas, Catherine Zeta-Jones, and Benicio del Toro. It's won the top award from the New York Film Critics Association, and Soderbergh was named Best Director of 2000 by the New York and L.A. Film Critics for directing Aaron Brockovich and Traffic. Film critic Henry Sheehan has a review of Traffic.
The most outstanding feature of Steven Soderbergh's enthralling new dramatic thriller, Traffic, is simply how many things it does well. It ranges over locations from Washington, D.C. to Tijuana. The list of Casablanca-style characters include a shady, khakis-wearing San Diego lawyer, a stereo-obsessed professional assassin, and a know-it-all prep school druggie. And it looks at the drug trade from an array of angles, from a frustrated middle managers in the smuggling end of it to a failed drug war bureaucrats. Most impressively, it manages to keep track of three and a half, major plot lines. Soderbergh uses filters and film stocks to create three wholly different visual styles for the three tales. The most impressive stylistic adaptation and the movie's best narrative strand is used to follow Javier Rodriguez, a Mexican policeman played with unusual restraint and enormous charisma by Benicio del Toro. Shot in what looks like overexposed sepia, Javier is basically an honest man trying to do his job in an intensely corrupt and impoverished environment. Javier is what Americans might call poor, or at least deprived, and is frustrated professionally. So he's ripe for picking when the Mexican army's lead anti-drug general, a man named Salazar, recruits him for his unit. Javier ingratiates himself with Salazar by slipping across the U.S. border to kidnap an assassin for the general. but Salazar has the killer tortured, the first of Javier's disillusioning experiences. Eventually, Javier decides to indulge in some trickery of his own, but it's not clear to what end exactly. Is he going crooked, siding with another faction in the anti-drug alliance, or has he put a murkier agenda in play? When he slips some information on the general to some American DEA agents, even they have trouble figuring out just what Javier wants.
So now that you have what you want, let's talk about how I get what I want.
Oh, you don't have to worry about that. You're not gonna have any problems there.
Yeah, but first let's talk about what precautions you're taking to protect yourself.
You worry about getting me what I want. I worry about myself.
Javier isn't the only character trying to run trick plays. In San Diego, Helena Ayala, a country clubbing pregnant woman played by Catherine Zeta-Jones, is shocked when her husband is arrested for cocaine smuggling. Helena is shadowed by two narcs, marvelously played by Don Cheadle and Luis Guzman, and badly counseled by her husband's self-serving partner, nicely impersonated by Dennis Quaid. Yet she manages to find out what her husband's business was and gets to choose what to do about it. The San Diego sequences are shot in more or less routine, bright colors. Michael Douglas stars as an Ohio judge in sequences that are bathed in cold cobalt blue. Appointed by the president to be the nation's new drug czar, Douglas's character is unaware that his own daughter is fooling with cocaine. Caroline, the daughter, ends up performing the most degrading rites of manipulation, sleeping with a dealer for drugs. It's both expected and fitting that Soderbergh would find such a simple, effective use for shooting with different kinds of film. The technique is a current Hollywood fashion, popularized by Oliver Stone, and reaching its nadir in the Sandra Bullock vehicle, 28 Days. But given that videotape is often one of the elements in these stylistic melanges, you could say that Soderbergh isn't only the man who tamed the approach, but who pioneered it. His first film was 1989's Sex, Lies, and Videotape. Lately, Soderbergh has been on a roll, directing Out of Sight, The Limey, Aaron Brockovich, and now Traffic in rapid succession. For those who wonder whether Soderbergh deserves admission to the Palace of Auteurism, the 37-year-old filmmaker does indeed have a theme. All his movies are about powerless people trying to effect change through the manipulation of the powerful. Whether a spunky working-class paralegal or a Mexican cop, Soderbergh's characters are thrown back on the only thing left to them, their guile. Not bad for a filmmaker who is a pretty effective and honest manipulator himself.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. We want to congratulate our language commentator, Jeffrey Nunberg, on receiving the Linguistics, Language, and the Public Interest Award from the Linguistic Society of America for his work on Fresh Air. Thanks, Jeff, for your great work. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of Flags of Our Fathers by James Bradley with Ron Powers, a story of the men who raised the flag on Iwo Jima. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk about manic depression and suicide with Kay Redfield Jamison. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.